Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hazing is illegal in Ohio and, in fact, all but six states. But the practice remains a common occurrence among members of college fraternities, sororities, and sports teams. Sometimes hazing ends in death. In February, Penn State University student Tim Piazza died 12 hours after heavily drinking, falling several times, and being left to die by several members of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity. The year before, five football players from the small evangelical Christian Wheaton College in Illinois allegedly kidnapped, beat, and threatened to sodomize a younger teammate. Those players, including the son of legendary OSU football player Chris Spielman, face criminal charges. Columbus-based filmmaker David Berkman has tried to capture the spirit and the menace of college hazing in his award-winning feature film, Haze. The film releases theatrically on October 13th, and we'll hear from David Berkman later in the program. Joining us now by phone is former college football player and Chicago Tribune sports columnist, David Huff. Welcome to the show. David, did I pronounce your name right?
No, it's David Haw.
Sorry about that.
Good to be here, Ann.
Good. David, is the Wheaton College incident a common occurrence?
Well, I don't want to go as far as to say that the result of what happened is common on college campuses and college football programs. I think that what we have reported on, what we know, it's an extreme example of hazing gone too far. What I think is common is the act of initiation where that rises to the level of what we now call hazing is that, younger players, freshman players are compelled to do something to prove themselves worthy of being treated like an upperclassman. Sometimes it gets out of hand. And I think in this case, we all can agree, or most of us can agree, that it's an example of that. I don't want to say that every college campus goes to such extremes, but I do think that most sports teams, that college football teams in this case specifically, have some form of hazing. Yeah.
You wrote that part of the issue is coaches that want the players to sort out hierarchy on their own.
Sure. Yeah. College football coaches, it's somewhat of a militaristic approach to everything in the sport. I mean, you got guys who quote military leaders. You have structure that is sought, and a hierarchy has to exist in a locker room. Leaders, followers, people that understand that they can work up the ranks, if you will. So it is that kind of approach, and so there's this also this unspoken sort of acceptance of this hazing issue, which guys need to be treated like plebes, if you will, or treated like until they're to the point where they can be trusted or until they mature. And hey, look, that can range anything from, as I pointed out, when I played college football at Ball State and. Mm-hmm. The late 1980s. I mean, it was as innocent as singing your school fight song in front of 100 of your teammates, which could be, frightening for people that you just met and trying to have you taken seriously. So that to me was, but it goes the other end of the spectrum too, to people who get taped to goalposts and get abducted from their rooms in the case of the Wheaton College incident. So there's a wide range of things that we're talking about here. And when you cross a certain line, I think is when you have to be very, very responsive. And that's why, in my mind, it's dangerous because the line is blurrier than ever. And people just, don't know either, or in the case of maybe, some coaches or administrators don't want to know where that line is and when it's being crossed.
College officials at Wheaton responded. The accused did community service. Is there an obligation to report the crime to law enforcement?
Yeah, I would think that if you have a suspicion that there is a crime that's being committed, I think you have every obligation if you're an educator.
Just like rape or anything like that.
Yeah, because, you know, you don't know how, if they concluded through their own investigations there were potential crimes committed here, and I'm not convinced they didn't, and it's pretty vague and cloudy as to what exactly they did, you know, they did conclude.
Mm-hmm.
But something went wrong here. Something went wrong to the point where they felt like it needed to be addressed and punished, and the punishment really should have been more severe than 50 hours of community service and an essay, okay? They are a court of law, and it's not a penal system, but if you have any the slightest hint of doubt, then you need to turn it over to the authorities who can figure this out. And I don't know, frankly, Ann, the how it got in front of the legal authorities and how that happened, because it did take them a long time.
Yeah, about a year, yeah.
There's been some criticism leveled about that, and I understand that. My thought would be better late than never, and I do wonder what took so long. So there were enough issues with how this was handled internally, and I guess your radar goes up a little bit as a reporter to make you wonder what else went wrong. So,
or what other things have gone similar route.
Well, what other things have gone similar, because as I wrote and as I believe, you know, this doesn't usually happen as a one-time deal.
Mm-hmm.
There had to have been a culture of permissiveness that existed that allowed these players to feel empowered enough to go into a teammate's room, remove him forcibly from the premises, put him in the back of a car, put a sheet over his head, taunt him, and then leave him half naked on a football field. Okay? There had to be some precedent here that gave those guys the idea, like, okay, let's do this. I don't know any of the five guys, but I don't want to give them credit to think that they just were original, sat around and said, let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a culture when you have a longtime coach in a successful program that sometimes develops under the surface, beneath the surface, and behind the scenes. That's the problem. The problem isn't necessarily the facts and, well, was there enough to raise a level to a criminal charge here? And, you know, did he or didn't they, sexual assault being alleged here? No, nobody's saying that there is or was. I'm saying that Wheaton College investigated this. They accepted certain facts to be true, the ones I just described. They accepted those to be bad enough to where they had to discipline these players. To me, that says the culture has a problem here. And the problem is that the hazing culture, you have to eradicate that from your program.
You know, you wrote that hazing is bullying hidden behind the mask of tradition, and you said that hazing isn't a nod to letting boys be boys as much as opening the door to deviants being deviants.
And I believe that, because all that hazing is somebody's way of telling, of making you feel intimidated. And it's intimidation disguised as tradition. Because there's this tradition in fraternities, in sporting teams, that you're not as good as me because you're not as old as me, or you've not been here long enough, which is garbage to me, okay, which is ridiculous to assume. And it's dangerous to execute. So, yeah, I totally believe hazing is nothing more than bullying by cowards.
You know,
it announces that you're here do something to me based on one thing, and that's because I'm not as old as you.
I just want to remind listeners that my guest, David Haugh, of the Chicago Tribune, he's a sports columnist there, is also a former college football player from Ball State, so he knows about what he speaks. Listeners, if there's someone out here who's experienced hazing, who has been a perpetrator of hazing, wants to talk about it and tell their side of the story, love to hear from you, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. David, what is the role, in your opinion, of the federal student privacy law in all of this? Because that's part of what the college officials at Wheaton said prevented them from going public with this. Or telling people more about what they know.
I think it's valid to examine. But I do think that prevents them from being, you know, from having an announcement, from being too detailed in what happened. But, Ann, that's not really on the list of things that went wrong here. That's not at the top of it.
Hmm.
Okay? at the top of the list, from my perspective only, as a former college football player that's covered college and professional sports for 25 years, and who has a son who's a 17-year-old hockey player, who I know this stuff is still part of the culture in sports. We had a high school in the suburban Chicago area that shut down their football program last week for temporarily because of hazing accusations. I don't need to tell you. We're talking about it today because it remains an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Wheaton College can talk about all they want about the privacy laws preventing them from doing this or that, but they need to really focus on their own internal problems. They have a hazing culture. If they didn't, we wouldn't be talking about this. If they didn't, we wouldn't be seeing five players turn themselves into authorities 18 months after the fact. If they didn't have that issue, there would be no privacy law to hide behind. So that, to me, is the problem. Places like Wheaton College that want to use every bureaucratic crutch they can to ignore the obvious, which is staring them in the face. And that's that you have kids that feel empowered to do something they shouldn't, and something that shows a disrespect for the people that they're in the same classroom with, the same locker room with.
That's
got to be unacceptable.
When you started at Ball State, what were your expectations about hazing? You said that you were made to sing your high school fight song in front of everybody, which I suppose is embarrassing. I'm actually proud of singing mine. I guess when you're a big He-Man football player, right? But what were your expectations? How did they prepare you for all this?
There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of anxiety. There's a lot of acceptance of the idea that you need to be humbled because you are joining a locker room that, you know, in a physical sport where you figure you're going to be humbled. So you have coaches that, you know, I think kind of wink and nod and look the other way to a point.
Mm-hmm.
We had as I mentioned, my head coach is Paul Schudel. He played college football at Miami of Ohio. He was a terrific man, is a terrific man. He respects people. He didn't tolerate anything that went beyond what I think is harmless fun. And I think that's what I would characterize singing your fight song in front of mm-hmm. friends like you're at a party as harmless fun.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, reinforced the idea that, you know, you need to get past a certain level of self-consciousness when you're in this group. And mm-hmm. there's a camaraderie that is trying to be built. That's okay. But again, that to me falls under the umbrella of hazing. But it's more of a socialization issue or maybe example. Hazing gets dangerous when you take the fight song becomes doing shots and trying to, you know, force alcohol down somebody's throat and have them do something that they wouldn't ordinarily do if they were, you know, under their own power. That's where I think you can't trust 18 to 22-year-old young men to know where the line is. So in my mind, you just eliminate hazing altogether. You can't tolerate or accept it. And that, to me, is the safest route here.
Well,
that's not what anybody really wants to hear, though, who's been immersed in a college football environment or culture that has allowed it for so many years.
It's illegal in 46 or 44 states. It's illegal. What else can be done? I mean, are the laws targeting the wrong people? Should it be targeting the coaches? Should it be targeting higher ups in universities where it occurs? What do you think?
I think it has to start. You know, you start with small steps, but it starts with accountability. And I think that, you know, the focus is on these five young men, all of whom seem to be, you know, have pretty solid backgrounds as mm-hmm. student athletes, and this is not about these five young men. Okay, I know Wheaton College and the authorities have to look at the criminal system and let it run its course. We're not assuming anything about their guilt
mm-hmm.
or their innocence, frankly. Mm-hmm. But the accountability comes from the people who were in charge to help these guys mature from young men into mature young men by the time they're done. Coaches, administrators. How did they respond? Assistant coaches. What's the culture you're creating? Those are the questions they have to ask. Those are the questions that have to be answered. This isn't about some 21-year-old kid who got too bold and put somebody in the back of a car. This is about the coaching staff and the people on that campus that knew this, if they didn't know this was happening, why didn't they? Or did they create a culture where this permissiveness existed? That's where you start, and that trickles down from the high school into the high school levels to where it's not accepted, and you just have to have a measure of accountability when these things do go awry.
David Haugh, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Ann. Take care.
David Haugh is a former college football player for Ball State, and he's a Chicago Tribune sports columnist. We'll have a link to his columns on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, we're going to hear from Columbus-based filmmaker who has written and directed an award-winning feature film entitled Haze. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
We talk about brotherhood. You have to work for it. You've got to hunger for it. You've got to launch, dive, and bleed for it.
Welcome to hell.
That's a clip from the feature-length film Haze. It's a fictional story about college fraternity life and the role of hazing. The practice is not only common, it can end tragically, as with the case of Penn State University student Tim Piazza, who died 12 hours after drinking heavily, falling, and being left to die by several members of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity there last February. Joining us now by phone is Professor of Higher Education at the University of Maine College of Education and Human Development, Elizabeth Allen. She studies hazing and trains college staff on how to prevent it. Welcome to the show, Elizabeth Allen.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is the writer and director of Haze, Columbus-based filmmaker David Berkman. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
David, you wrote in a piece for USA Today that you would do it again, and we talked about it off the air, but I want you to clarify what you meant by that, that you would go through the hazing experience yourself again.
Yeah, well, first of all, I mean, just so listeners know a little bit about what I experienced when I was pledging my fraternity at Indiana University, I would say that my experience runs somewhere in the middle of the spectrum in terms of what people actually endure when they experience hazing. But that it's an escalating process. It started with, you know, fairly innocuous things like having to sing serenades to girls, having to clean the house, having to run errands, do a scavenger hunt, things that we might not necessarily always associate with hazing. And then they escalate to this place where you're being forced to consume mass amounts of alcohol, concoctions of unknown things. During our Hell Week, we had to participate in something called Beta Baseball, where we outside had these industrial-sized trash cans, and we were forced to drink beer until we vomited. And then that meant you had a hit. You would run to the first industrial-sized trash can, get inside of it. It was filled with ice water, vomit, other kinds of bodily fluids that I don't even know what they were. And then you'd get out of that trash can when the next pledge would advance, and you would have to run naked to the next one. We, during our Hell Week, experienced intense sleep deprivation for days, again, forced alcohol consumption, lineups in sort of the style of sort of like what we think of when we think of like military drill sergeants screaming in your face,
right,
being spit on, pretty hardcore things. So then, you know, you ask, why would I do it all again? I mean, today, if I were literally transplanted with the brain I have now into the body
as an adult,
into the body of an 18-year-old, I don't think I would do that again. But I will say this. I think that, you know, when you are 18 and technically you're an adult, but honestly, let's be real, you're not. You're leaving home for the very first time. You're having to create a whole new social network, meet all new friends. It's a very scary time in life, I think. And for me, I went to a large university. And what I think you want to do is you want to shrink your world, right? You want to make it smaller and you want to feel safe and you want to find that sense of home. Fraternities and sororities with their palatial palaces, their literal houses,
right,
give you that sense that you are back at home. and you can join this smaller group and you can participate in something that feels like there's structure to your social life.
Elizabeth, from your studies of hazing, has David Berkman done a pretty good job of describing the appeal?
Yes, I think that really is an accurate description for many in terms of the appeal of wanting to belong. Of course, everyone wants to belong to something and feel at home and feel safe. But, you know, I think what most people find very troubling and disturbing about hazing is sort of that irony there. Like, how does this reflect brotherhood or sisterhood, or how does this reflect team when we're actually participating in activities that are abusive and degrading and humiliating and sometimes life-threatening?
David Berkman, the film focuses on a fraternity, but there's a prominent role for the sister sorority that you deal with in a less direct way. It's a little bit more obtuse, but it's certainly there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that that's something that's often overlooked, that sororities do haze as well, not only within themselves internally, but there's also a hazing that goes on in the relationship between fraternities and sororities, the way in which the men and women are sort of quote unquote forced to relate to one another often are in degrading or humiliating ways. Hazing with women tends to be more psychological in nature. It has to do with body image, some of the things that people that come up in our research over and over again, the same anecdotes, the same stories of what people experience, have a lot to do with either singing crude songs to the men or doing physical things with the men.
Like
sexual acts. Having to lick chocolate off of males who are dressed down into their underwear. This just happened at a major university we know and was in the news a couple of years ago. And so it's definitely very prevalent in sororities. We just don't hear about it quite as much.
Elizabeth Allen, do fraternities and sororities that do this, I mean, what does it say about the people who endure this? What does it say about David Berkman? I mean, what does it say to us about what they're doing?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, when people think about hazing, one of the first images that often comes to mind is something along the lines of what David described, or the Animal House image from the movies. But our research shows that hazing is more widespread, that students experience hazing in many different kinds of groups on different campuses, including club sports as well as, you know, formal intercollegiate sports, but club sports, intramural sports, academic groups and honoraries, and, you know, other, you know, performing arts groups, marching bands, and so forth.
Right.
So it is far more widespread, and I think, you know, of those students who participate in these groups, more than half say they've experienced behavior that meets the definition of hazing. So, you know, I think it's really kind of, you know, common for people to look at the victims or those who go forward and participate in this and wonder what is going on. Are they so desperate for friends? Are they so, you know, I've heard people say this or ask me directly, you know, geez, their self-esteem must be so low. Why would anyone go through that? But that isn't what I've seen. You know, when I talk to the students who've participated in this, many of them, most are very, you know, successful socially. They have good grades, you know, mm-hmm. So there is no one size fits all with explaining hazing. It's very complex. And I think that's something that we really have to be aware of as well.
Yeah. I want to take a caller real quick. Josh in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Josh.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. You might want to turn down the radio.
Okay. Sorry.
Okay. That's okay. Go ahead. You're in a fraternity.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a member of Lambda Gamma Epsilon. Small liberal arts college with mainly local fraternities and sororities.
Yeah.
And to me, the issue is that we need mentally and experientially beneficial programs. We need new member education that builds people up in order to eliminate issues like rape culture, like binge drinking that is so commonly associated with Greek life. And when you get into the sort of physical elements of forced drinking, sexual acts, any of this, it's just absolutely reprehensible. Sort of like what David Hoff was speaking on, the culture of permissiveness is absolutely what we need to eliminate. What we need is when somebody decides to say, hey, we should add this dangerous or demeaning element to pledging programs, it takes good men and women to stand up and say, hey, no, we will not allow this. These are our new members. These are the people we want to be around, to spend time with, who we want to join us, and we shouldn't treat them like that.
Yeah. So you're working on that at your fraternity at Otterbein.
Oh, absolutely. We're coming up here in about a week or so. We are taking new members in and entering into the new member education program.
All right. Well, Josh, thank you so much for your call.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Anyone else? 614-292-8513. And David Berkman?
Oh, I was just going to say, I'd like to add something about, you know, my theory as to why someone would endure this kind of abuse. From my thinking back on my own experience, while I was going through it, I have to say that the experience was a rush. It was a thrill.
The adrenaline type of
thing.
There's
an adrenaline. And you feel very alive. It's a very visceral experience. And of course, at that time in your life, you also feel safe. This does not feel dangerous. You do not ever imagine when you're 18 years old that any of these things could cause a death. It's like going to a horror movie or riding an amusement park ride. You feel like you're in this safe contraption where it's thrilling to be sort of given the experience of almost feeling like you're in jeopardy, but you don't ever really feel like you are. And so I think that there's something – I don't want to get too psychological, but I think there's something primal in this where you have to think of – particularly in fraternities and sororities, people are very privileged who join these clubs. And we have not experienced an intense amount of suffering in our lives. And I think there's something in the human being that requires a certain amount of fight or flight to be triggered every now and then just to have that visceral sense. And so this manufactured, seemingly safe experience of going through this pledging process and being hazed, for the most part at the time, looking back, felt like a fun rush. And I think people don't – they're not aware. Another point I want to make, we've taken the film Haze to over 50 college campuses and we've screened there as part of a hazing prevention effort. Not the original intent of the film, but this was sort of a byproduct. We're very happy to have done it. But at one of the last screenings, I asked the audience of 400-plus fraternity and sorority members if anyone had heard of the name Tim Piazza. Nobody raised their hand. Nobody. Nobody had heard about this
a guy that just died
a
last
guy who
February.
Just died
I mean,
last February.
The videos were viral. Do you really believe that nobody heard?
It's fascinating to me. I mean, the eyes that were looking upon me told me, no, these people are not aware of this. So the level of, you know, the last caller who talks about, you know, sort of building awareness, this is not happening.
Hmm.
You know, the level of awareness out there is very, very minimal.
Does any, you know, when you're listening to this, Elizabeth Allen, and your work, it rings true?
Absolutely. Yes, I would agree that there is a lack of awareness and understanding about the potential harm that can come with hazing. And so I think we really have to start, you know, prevention efforts need to begin there. We found also there's just a major disconnect in students who experience hazing and their willingness to call it hazing. Only 1 in 9 are actually label the experience hazing, and that's partly because they only see the most extreme ends of the hazing spectrum as hazing. And so we can do a lot to prevent the more egregious hazing if we can help people understand there's a full spectrum, and if we can intervene earlier, you know, before it goes along the slippery slope that David described in his pledging experience.
Well, here's an email from Michael. This is interesting. He says, I experienced hazing as early as seventh grade junior high football. It was traumatic, degrading, and I didn't play that sport anymore where I was to be subjected or involved in anything where I would be hazed. The scariest part was all of the older players chasing us down and rounding us up against the fence and then hitting us with cleats and threatening us not to tell. That's in the seventh grade. You know, I was preparing for another show on concussions, and a writer wrote about her own two sons who seems like pretty abruptly decided not to continue in football as youngsters, I think in elementary or junior high school. And I'm wondering whether hazing might have had something to do with it.
Yeah, I would agree that very well could be. I think
it's shocking that it'd be going on that young, though. Maybe
it
not.
It is shocking, but it is happening. Absolutely. It's happening in high schools and in middle schools. I know, you know, because I'm a parent myself, and I hear from other parents and also from through the Stop Hazing website, people write in. And so, yeah, we really need to be doing more at that level and in terms of helping students and their families understand the potential harm here and how we can accomplish the same goals in other ways, you know, whether it's a sense of accomplishment or that rush, you know, that someone wants to get. Well, we can do that, but we don't have to do it in a way that puts people at risk, at such great risk. You know, if it's brotherhood, sisterhood, if it's team bonding, you know, we can accomplish all those things without having hazing.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why we feel pretty strongly that having young people watch the movie Haze is a very potent way to get a dialogue started early. We've had several screenings where adults with younger children have—
Like high schoolers.
Yes, who have said to us, we regret not bringing our 16-year-old son or daughter to this screening. We were told, you know, this is a rated R movie. And, you know, it's a hard watch for young people. But at the same time, we've had many parents say we really feel it would be valuable for our youngster who's about to go to college to see this now because it would better prepare them for what, you know, eventuality may occur. And I think that fraternities and sororities could screen this film to their new members or even before the rushing process, which, you know, we probably would get some resistance because the fear would be that they see this and people wouldn't want to join because they'd be terrified of what they may be about to experience.
Or maybe educated about what they're about to experience.
Exactly.
Elizabeth Allen, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Elizabeth Allen is a professor of higher education at the University of Maine College of Education and Human Development. She studies the practice of hazing. Still with us will be David Berkman. He's Columbus-based filmmaker, writer. He wrote and directed the award-winning feature film Haze. It releases theatrically October 13th. It will be playing at the Gateway Theater in Columbus on November 9th. For more information, check out the website at wosu.org/allsides. We'll get to some calls. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the practice of hazing in college sports and Greek life and also in college bands. And apparently, according to an email from Michael, it went all the way back to his experiences as a seventh grade football player. Still with us is Columbus-based filmmaker David Berkman. He directed and wrote the award-winning film Haze. It's a fictional portrayal of college hazing, fraternal hazing, but it is based in part on David Berkman's own experiences in a college fraternity. Hayes releases theatrically October 13th. It'll also be playing at the Gateway on November 9th. For more information, go to the website. Go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Also, it's available for pre-order on iTunes at half price this weekend, so you might want to check that out. Joining us now by phone is New York-based psychologist and expert witness in hazing cases, Dr. Susan Lipkins. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What led you to become an expert on the subject of hazing? What interested you about it?
No, I'm glad that you asked. As a psychologist, there was a hazing case in 2003 close by in a high school. Three kids came back from a preseason football camp, and they were sodomized with broomsticks, pine cones, and golf balls covered in icy hot. And I was wondering why kids would do this to each other, and especially in a small town where everybody really grew up knowing each other.
Yeah.
I started to do research, and I found that there were like 50 hits on Google, and nobody had really looked at hazing. So I started to look at it, and I actually wanted to do a documentary. And I think my crew was the only crew that actually got to speak with the parents of the victims and the coach and such. Never finished the documentary. It ended up in a book called Preventing Hazing, How Parents, Teachers, and Coaches Can Stop the Violence, Harassment, and Humiliation. And I do believe that I was in the original Haze movie, so I'm not quite sure. The filmmaker's on the line, so maybe he'll tell me. But basically, I wanted to look as a psychologist as to why kids would do this to each other. What is the psychological basis of this? And then I found out, you know, through the last 15 years or so, that sodomy has become more popular, specifically on athletic teams in high school, and that sexualized hazing in general has spread from high schools to colleges to in the athletic teams as well as in, you know, fraternities and Greek life. And there's a huge morphing of hazing, and it's getting, in my opinion, more common, more violent, and more sexualized.
Wow. So whatever we think we're out there doing to prevent it is not working.
Not working. What's happening is, just like I happen to be an expert in bullying, too, what the research shows is that we have increased the kids' knowledge of what hazing is or of what bullying is, but it hasn't stopped what we call pure-on-pure violence. We really, you know, we're doing a lot in bystander intervention, trying to get kids to report, but we don't really have the kind of systems that are anonymous and safe and that people feel like they can report and that they're going to be, that there'll be positive consequences for their reporting. I think in general, the whole the United States is starting to realize that we have a responsibility when we see something to say it, like in New York, all the subways say, see it, say it, you know, if we see something suspicious, and that we're trying to train our children to do that as well. But we don't have the authorities really buying in and creating systems that will make that happen in a positive way.
I agree with that. I'll say in our experience taking the film to college campuses and screening, we've had many wonderfully positive experiences, but there have been occasions where there's been blowback, not just from the students who deny that these things happen, but then from the administrators who have organized the event. They have a tendency at times, and I think there's a culture going on, unfortunately, in college life today where the administration sort of coddle the students and they're very afraid of doing anything that will offend them. And so when you present something like a film that is challenging and that really, you know, gets under people's skin, if people show that they're upset, the administrators sort of want to stop the conversation rather than actually start it.
Can I add something
to that? Sure.
I think that it's not just that. I think that there's a symbiotic relationship with the colleges and hazing. A lot of people feel like, you know, it happened to me, it can happen to you, it's part of life, it's not a big deal, don't be a pussy. And also they find that the members of Greek life who come back and are alumni and are excited about, you know, coming back, they give a lot of money to the college. So the Greek life provides a social kind of event that attracts students, and then the alumni give more money. So they don't want kids to get hurt, and they don't want hazing to happen, but they often look away, like, wink, wink, it's not so bad, you know, this is part of the culture, this is part of the fun. And they look at it kind of like Animal House, not really recognizing all the dangers and the increasing dangers that are happening every day.
100%. There's a scene in our film where I tried to capture a phenomenon that happened when I was in school, which we call belovedly the Dean's Raid. And in the scene, yeah, the dean actually comes to a party fully knowing that there is binge drinking going on, that there is – all the rules are being broken. They know exactly – he knows exactly what's going on behind frat house walls. But he sort of gently reminds the president, you know, look, you're – you know, be careful.
Hey, I like you guys.
I like you guys. I'm looking out for you. But you just got to, you know, make sure you don't step over the line.
By the way, this is a campus where a kid has died the year before.
100%.
Right. So 100%. This is – there's a hyper awareness going on. I want to get to a few calls. Tony in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Tony. You're surprised that hazing has stuck around. Why?
Actually, from my original comments when I spoke with the gentleman in listening to your discussion, I actually kind of want to spin that a little different now, because you brought up a very good point. You know, where do we draw the clinical definition between straight up bullying and hazing?
Go ahead, Tony.
And the other point is, we know the problem exists. You know, I found it personally amusing, the email. You know, I remember in seventh grade, you know, I grew up in Southern Ohio. You know, exact same thing happened all up through high school, things of that nature. The difference is, with us back then, we accepted it as what it was, as being part of the team, as just how things were. And unfortunately, as we got older and progressed on with the team and the sport, we became the ones doing the thing.
So you became complicit then?
Absolutely, totally. We all. But you bring up the other great point in this politically correct age that we live in. It's almost like everybody's hands is tied. We know that this is going on, just like bullying. You know, when I was growing up 20-some years ago, you handled a bully by punching them in the mouth. They left you alone after that. We don't do that anymore, which that's a whole other debate for a different show. But, you know, it just seems like, you know, we know the problems are there. They're identified. Yeah. But what do we do? It's like administration's hands are tied. You know, when I was a deputy in Northern Nevada, we actually went to schools after kids would get in fights. You know, 20 years ago, a couple kids going at it on the playground, we never gave it a second thought. I mean, where's the fix?
Well, let's hear from my guest, Dr. Susan Limpkins. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I'm busting. Yeah. Okay. I think there are two things. One is when you said he became the perpetrator, I'd just like to explain what I call the blueprint of bullying, or hazing, excuse me, is that you come in, you just want to join the team or the group, you're a victim. The next year, you become a bystander, you watch as others get hazed, and then eventually you become the perpetrator, and you do onto others what has been done to you. You throw that blueprint into your backpack, and you take it with you to the military, to college, and to the workplace. And you expect to haze and be hazed. Kids come into college, 79% of the high school graduates going to NCAA teams have already been hazed. So they come in pre-hazed and ready to haze. So I think that, you know, that is consistent with the caller. The other piece is that I particularly make a distinction between bullying and hazing. And to me, bullying is an individual act. It's usually one person who's the bully and maybe has some friends around him, but he's like spontaneously picking on somebody else who either has lower social status or is physically smaller, and they want to get something individually. They want to get something. They want to get their homework. They want to get lunch. They want to get, you know, money, or they want to prove that they're stronger. What happens with hazing is completely different. It is planned. It's planned the year before. There's a beginning, there's a middle, and there's an end.
Yeah, it's kind of complicated stuff, intricate.
Very intricate, and it's a lot of planning. It's like planning a bar mitzvah or a big party, you know? And they have, you know, they have money involved, they have alcohol involved, they have paddling involved, they have all kinds of things and places to go, people to drive, things to do, a million ways to get hurt, basically. And it happens every year in the same way. You know, there's a tradition here, and we're going to repeat that tradition. We like to add our own fingerprint, which means they increase the alcohol, the paddling, or the sexuality, but basically they're doing the same thing over and over again. And the reason is no one individual is getting something. It's just proving that you're good enough to be part of the group. And so you're being integrated into this, group. And in order to do that, you have to do all these things just like we had to do. And then you're showing that you're good enough to be one of us and we're special and different. And, you know, you move on from there. So bullying is more individualistic and you spontaneous and you get something. Hazing is a group activity. It's got a lot of planning. And my definition is it's a process used by groups to maintain a pecking order or hierarchy and to discipline.
Yeah, one qualification I would just like to make, I agree with most of what you've said, is that I think it's important to identify that while it is very planned, the hazing process is very planned, not everyone in the fraternity participates at the same level. For example, right. I never hazed anybody. I was hazed. I endured it. I went through the entire process. But I was sort of one of those guys in the fraternity who would say to the pledges coming in, like, hey, if you're having a really tough time, come see me.
Oh, and you were the good guy.
I was the good guy. Yeah. I mean, and the thing is, there's a lot of us like that. And then there's another middle group, which are the observers, the people who attend the hazing. I never even went.
Wow. I thought you had to.
No, it wasn't required. I'm sure there are some fraternities where it's required. In ours, it wasn't. It was all optional. I never participated. Some people went and they watched and they just were aloof in the background. And then there are the hardcore hazers, the people who are really doing it. I think it's important to understand that. Because I think if you start thinking about prevention, the place to start is to identify the people who aren't actually perpetrating or the people who are just bystanders.
Well, let me just say, as a hazing expert in actual hazing cases where people go to court, that frequently everybody's held responsible because they do know about it.
Yeah.
And I would advise everybody to make sure that their children do not become the presidents of these Greek organizations,
right,
or the captains or the pledge master, because they end up being held responsible even when, and frequently the president doesn't care what's happening. He knows what's happening. He's not there present, but he's still being held responsible because he has that.
And we still think of them as kids, but the fact is they're legally adults.
It doesn't matter, even in high school.
But it doesn't matter.
They know exactly what the hell they're doing, you know. And sometimes it's sexual assault, and sometimes it's battery, and sometimes it's murder, you know. Sometimes kids die from hazing. But it doesn't matter. I mean, we really need to understand that the people who are hazing understand that they're doing something that, A, is illegal, against policy, and is potentially harmful. But they have this kind of security called the code of silence that they won't get caught and that nothing bad will happen to them. And the truth is that there are thousands of hazings that happen, and that code of silence is not broken. And so they go on and on and on.
And you make a very good point, though, that they are technically adults. And I think that is actually we should recognize that as an obstacle because they can hide behind that fact in a sense. Because if you really want to prevent these things, in my opinion, particularly in fraternities and sororities, you cannot actually treat these people as full-fledged adults because really the behavior, they're not behaving like children. They're behaving like animals. And until they stop behaving like animals, we need real adults, people of authority, to live in the house with them.
Huh. Yeah, like they used to.
To have a 100% ban on alcohol, because alcohol, we haven't talked about this much, is behind all
it's
of
so
this.
Embedded.
If you want to prevent death, you've got to get rid of the alcohol. Now, they're always going to find a way to
do it. No, it's not only alcohol. There's a lot of other drugs and stuff. But
you know, they're always going to find a way to get it. But if you have a true adult presence around the clock, monitoring what's going on at every single activity, I think you'll curb this.
I don't 100% agree. There are fraternities that have these house moms and people living in the house, but they do what the administration does, which is turn a cheek. Also, in the typically black fraternities, for example, there's no alcohol involved necessarily, but there's a lot of paddling involved and a lot of actual physical harm that goes on. So it's not only alcohol. I agree 100% that alcohol and drugs makes everything much worse, you know, just accentuates everything. And I think we have a whole bunch of alcoholics being grown on our college campuses every day. But it's not only that. And I believe it really, the prevention starts in high school, and the prevention starts with really educating parents as well as students.
Dr. Susan Lipkins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Susan Lipkins is a psychologist and expert witness in hazing cases. Also, David Berkman, thanks to you as well.
Thank you for having me.
David Berkman's new film, Haze, will be released on October 13th. Learn more about it on our website at WOSU.org/All Sides. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.